on Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. Our December interview is with actor and writer Patterson Joseph. Currently appearing in BBC TV's drama Boat Story, Patterson Joseph came to widespread public attention for his role as Johnson in Channel 4's Peep Show. His debut novel, The Secret Diaries of Charles Ignatius Sancho, was published in 2022. It was shortlisted for the Jalak Prize and won the Christopher Bland Prize. The interviewer is Thomas Nixon.
So I just wanted to start with by saying that the Hidden Diaries aspect of the book is just a really interesting avenue to go down. Was this the original idea when you first envisioned the book?
Yeah, good question. So first of all, a pleasure to speak to you. And I'm really pleased when anybody takes an interest in Sancho. My name comes up as Ignatius Sancho on Zoom. My picture of me being Sancho comes up on that profile. My email address has got Sancho in it. I wanted to make him known. So the monodrama Sancho, An Act of Remembrance, was a bit like an audience with, here, let me introduce you to this guy who's blown my head off, the fact that he was alive in the 18th century and he did all these incredible things. But it was a very public show. The letters are very public too, actually, because hardly anybody could read or write. So the man or the woman of the house would probably read those letters out loud. So they're probably a little bit censored in that case. And then you've got the portrait, the Gainsborough portrait from 1768, which is so bright and vibrant. And again, the performance, it's like he's lit by a director of photography in there. And his look, you know, there's a real performance there. And the music he writes is really public dance music. So I wanted something private, Thomas. And to me, the most, and I've said this before, of course, in other places, but the most intimate form of storytelling to me is the novel. Because rather than the oral tradition, which I suppose if you don't understand the language, it would pretty much pass you by, but it gets handed down and changed and altered a bit. But in terms of words on a page, they're sort of fixed. Not only that, if you can decode the words, then even if it's thousands of years later, someone is speaking directly to you, forming images in your head based on those words that are indelible, that are unique to you. And it's so intimate. So what's more intimate in terms of writing a novel form than the sort of diary form, fictional diary form? He never wrote diaries as far as we know, but I wanted to imagine what it would be like to live internally, to see the internal life of the man. As an actor, that's what we do. We try to internalize our characters' words. So Hamlet might say to be or not to be, or that the famous speech that begins, oh, that this too sullied flesh might melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. But actually, what's behind that? It sounds like pretty poetic words. But what's behind that is if you hot-seated him, for example, and asked Hamlet what his problem was, he'd say, well, my mum just married my uncle. Oh, gosh, that's terrible. Not only that, but my dad died. My dad died 2 weeks ago. Now I've got to take off my funeral clothes and put on wedding clothes. It's ridiculous. And then you speak that speech with those thoughts, that energy, that feeling behind it. And so I wondered what was behind Sancho's words, because he speaks directly to England about its shameful involvement in the African human trafficking. The slave trade, as they kind of quite neatly call it. And yet he also wanted to be conversational. But that's where his writing is. It sits in that place of sort of public expression. So what was he really thinking behind? Where were his thoughts when he thought about his childhood, etc.? So the diary form came easily. How to structure it into a readable and not just sort of, it's Monday and today I'm going to have some, you know, kippers. It's Tuesday. Oh, I'm going to get my toenails clipped. It had been really tedious. So I had to find a form that meant that he could retrospectively look back and almost judge himself and get sort of deeply into his story, but as an older man.
It's brilliant that you say that, Patterson, because the next question really leads on to the words that are behind the text. What's the underlying theme? So Madeline mentioned when you were speaking at here, you really talked about Sancho's story on the surface really being about race, but deep down it's really about class and the inequalities of class. And I definitely picked up on that on as a subtext in the book when I was reading it. So I think just for this upcoming magazine theme on reality perspective, could you expand on that subtext of, yes, race is, I suppose, the circumstances, the context of Sancho's diaries. But in my opinion, what he's really talking about underneath that is class. And I think underlyingly, what else is at play in his writings, and what can we learn from that in today's world?
Wow, that's a big question. Wow. So I would say that you've got to understand that when you write something creatively, if it's any good, it usually is a little bit blind to you as the creator. You usually don't know if it's a good piece of work exactly what it is that you intended. I'm sure if you went to and I've heard people have tried to ask Samuel Beckett why he wrote Waiting for Godot, what was it all about? And he'll say things like symbiosis. But I mean, that doesn't really sum up all the strange highways and byways in which that story plays out. The mystery is also in the creator. You don't quite know what you've created. So when people retrospectively look back at your work, or when you're being asked to retrospectively look back at the work you've done, you can tend to almost break it down too much into themes and forms, and that's not what I did. I'm a storyteller. I don't really look for anything except links between one thing and another. And so when I look at it in its grand perspective, I think, yeah, the story is about the background of the African slave trafficking system. And that's where he begins his life. That's why the first chapter, which I entitle Origins, is about that life born on a slave ship, that little baby. And that's the context, and should always be the rumbling context of the background in which the whole novel plays out, even in the romantic bits, because there are romantic bits, even in the funny comic bits, because there are funny comic bits. So when we're breaking it down, I just want to be very careful that people don't get fooled into thinking that I've written some sort of polemic, any more than Oliver Twist is a polemic about the workhouse. It is also about the workhouse. It's also about poverty, but it's also about Fagin and the villain Bill Sykes and poor Nancy, and it's all about how this little child will survive in this terrible world. And we can extrapolate from that that we had a very unkind system towards the working poor and the poor in England. And it's the same with this novel. It's background, but it's an important background. So class and race. I think I don't particularly like using the word race because we're the human race. The cultural and ethnic separation came much stronger later when excuses had to be made for enslaving other humans. And so religious reasons were made. Biological, physiological reasons were made. We created scientific racism, really, eugenics, to make an excuse for what was happening. So that plays a part. Of course, it does. Now, when we talk about class, it is the prevailing issue in this country in particular. It is the biggest thing that undermines growth. It's the biggest thing that undermines our maturity as a nation. Because what we do is we crush talent based on the system that says, if you can afford to pay for this education, you can have this line in your life. You'll probably work here. You'll probably earn this much money. You'll probably live this long. And that is majorly stopping the growth of our nation in terms of ideas, the diversity of ideas. And a lot of people from the global majority who live in the United Kingdom suffer under that doubly, not only for their ethnicity, but also in terms of class and privilege. So that really is the truth of the world we live in, but it's not, if you like, what the novel is about. The novel will shine some light on that, but I just want to make it very clear that if you might be coming to it for polemic, you'd be sorely disappointed. As I say in my preface, this is not some sort of slavery porn where you know white people are made to feel guilty for the horrible things they're inflicting on black people, and black people are made to feel angry for the horrible things that white people are inflicting on them. That's not what I've written. What I've written is an articulate man who's being victimized by a system that wants to crush him, and about his survival, about how he manages to survive, all the compromises that he makes. He's a flawed character. So that's what I've written. And I it's not like I don't want to answer your question in that sort of binary way, but I think Santry's so non-binary as a character. He's so fluid and negotiates his world in the way he can in his time that I don't want anybody to think that I've somehow used him as a sort of cipher for my ideas about class or ethnicity.
I wanted to talk about your own voice as well and how important it was to shape those experiences in the story. And what was it like balancing both yours and Sancho's voices in writing the book?
So a quick biog, in case somebody doesn't really know Sancho's life story, is, as far as we know, there was only one biography written about him, and it's in the preface to the letters that were published in 1782, 2 years after he died. Made a lot of money for his family. It's very well subscribed. It was basically like pre-ordered. His wealth of knowledge would have come probably from his own learning. How did he get that? Well, he was born on a slave ship in 1729, according to Joseph Jekyll, the biographer. He was orphaned by the age of two. He was baptized Charles Ignatius in Colombia. He was shipped to England at that age, thereabouts, to live with three unmarried ladies in Greenwich. They wouldn't teach him how to read because they thought reading would make him unhappy, and it was the best way to keep a servant obedient. So class, again, most working class people couldn't read or write, and they were not encouraged to read or write. We had no universal education at that point. He runs away from home, ostensibly because they won't teach him how to read, and is found fortuitously by a guy called John, Duke of Montague, who believed in what to some already was seeming an extraordinary concept, black intelligence. And he had rescued several other black people from slavery. He believed in an equality that was beyond his time, actually. And John Montague gives him books secretly. So his wealth of knowledge comes from his own curiosity, Thomas. So there's a kind of hunger for knowledge. And I understand that in my own life, if you ask me about how my own voice and the story balance. Well, in the new show that I do, which I'm calling Sancho and Me for One Night Only, because it's quite improvised based on what the audience give me. But I splice his story into mine using the novel. And when I talk about education, if ever this pops up one evening, I'll always talk about the fact that I was part of that cohort of African Caribbean kids born in the 60s and 70s who were called educationally subnormal by the British establishment, this official term. And there's a BBC documentary called Subnormal, which you could look up on the iPlayer. So we treated as if we were never going to learn anything. And there was a bit of scientific racism in there too. And so I ran away from school pretty much when I was about 13, and I had the genius idea of bunking off, as we called it, playing truant, and I hid in a library. I was already a curious reader, and I would just read all day. So my learning really actually has come by my own curiosity, and because my day job as an actor means that sometimes I play characters who are long since dead in times that are long since passed, I've gotten really interested in research, and I probably have learned more about life and you know, everything through the research I've done into characters that I've played. So there's the sort of connection. And also, he was in a circle, Sancho. He happened to get lucky. And in that John Duke of Montague circle, you would have had philosophers like Montesquieu, the French philosopher. You would have had Handel, the composer. You would have had people like the younger Bach. His musical education would have been very rich, even if he was only eavesdropping. You would have had people like Samuel Johnson in that circle. You would have had Hogarth, David Garrick, the great actor of the 1700s in that circle. So he had a rich fund to draw on. He got very, very, very lucky. And it's actually what makes him a fascinating character, not his exceptionalism, but what he draws by being so lucky out of that. And what he draws out of that is, now that I've made myself known, I can represent my people more, with more authority. And that letter that he writes to Lawrence Stern, who was the writer of a book called Tristram Shandy, which is quite a tricky, funny novel, that letter is published, and people are saying, look, this is what a black man educated could sound like. So why are you pretending that the people that we're enslaving are not fully human, three-fifths human, as the American Constitution eventually had it. So there it is. And the thing about the novel, I suppose, is that it's a novel a bit like David Copperfield, where the person grows as it goes, that he knows more about the world as he goes through it. He doesn't start as somebody who knows everything. Even as the older man looking back at his life, he still knows, this is my life thus far. These are the things I've learned just now. And there's more to come. So you start him off as a baby, really, and a child, and finding out what the world is like. And I hoped by that to build the picture for all of us who don't really know the 18th century, and for all of us who don't really know what it would be like to be black in the 18th century, and to be black and free when so many of your people are enslaved. You have to start, I think, well, I had to start from scratch, so that my eyes, if you like, or as a reader, would be opened more and more, as Sancho's eyes, by the experiences, as you say, and encounters he makes open his eyes.
Absolutely. And that really comes to a head towards the end of the book at James Summerfield's trial. You really see his experiences and knowledge really come to a fore as he fights for the cause.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, James Somerset, actually, spelt in so many different ways, Thomas. I wouldn't be surprised that you quite forget it, but Somerset, sometimes with two M's, sometimes with two S's, sometimes with two T's. But that James Somerset case, actually, this is one of those things about research that's so fascinating when you start doing it. So Here's the basic facts. A man called James Somerset, an enslaved African-American, came with his master to London from, I think it was Virginia, but certainly in America. When the ship lands, after a little while, he escapes, gets himself baptized, because they believe to be baptized means you can't be enslaved again. Not true. And also, a lot of people believe there's no slavery in England. Again, not true. People still believe that today, by the way. I have Q&As all the time. And in America, too, where they say, did Britain ever have slavery? And they're not dumb. They just, that's the propaganda we've sold. So James Somerset runs and is recaptured after quite a while, I think. But in 1772, he's brought on board a ship about to go back to enslavement and is rescued by Thomas Clarkson, as well as others, I'm sure, who alerted him. The trial is like a seminal trial for the question of slavery in England. And the Lord Chief Justice is a guy called John Mansfield. And eventually, after months of deliberating, I think from May to September, because he's got the sugar lobby saying, you can't say there's no slavery in England, otherwise we're doomed. And he's also got, this is where the research is interesting, where he lives in Hampstead. Now it's called Hampstead, I suppose, and it's called Hampstead then, but where he's living is in Hampstead Heath, in a place called Canewood Hall. I think it's now Canewood Hall, or Canewood, and now called Kenwood House. But in that house, Thomas, when you do the research, he's living with his great-niece, Elizabeth, and his other great niece, Dido Elizabeth Bell, who is mixed heritage. So this story now becomes quite human, and that Somerset case that Sancho, I have Sancho witnessing, even though there's no record of him having witnessed it, but he did live in London and it was happening across the road from where he lived. So the likelihood is, this is a very interesting becomes an interesting story, not just a point of history, that a man with a black niece living with him is presiding over whether black people can be enslaved in England. And
it's
Sancho
a hypocrisy,
not, yeah, but Sancho could not be more interested in that. And I don't think that just because there's no letter or because there's no official record from some historian who would obviously tend to be male, obviously tend to be middle class and upper class and white, might not have been interested in recording Sancho's presence there. And Sancho may well not have recorded it because he was simply too busy running a shop with eight kids in it and his wife. But he certainly would have known about the trial and would have, I have imagined, but when I say imagined, it's not imagined out of wishful thinking. He literally had a shop across the road from where the trials were taking place at Westminster, in the hall there, which is now part of Parliament, which was a courtroom at the time. So for me, that's what's the beauty of connecting history with stories. As I say on stage, actually, quite often, the closest distance between two people is story. If I knew a little bit about you, I only know you as Thomas and you're interviewing me, I know nothing about you. But if I asked you what your parents did, I'd paint a bigger picture of you. And if you had siblings, and suddenly you become a more sort of fully rounded person to me. And I'll know you better and I'll understand you better when you ask questions or when I read your work. And this is what we're doing. It's not a case of lying or just making things up. You are taking from the archive and trying to build a story around it. There's a technique that is described by an African-American historian and writer called Saidiya Hartman. I'll write that in the chat. And it comes from her essay. She's written lots of things, but it comes from an essay that she wrote called Venus in Two Acts. And she talks about the fact that, you know, you're looking at the archive and it's threadbare. And you can have a birth date, place where they lived, and that's about it. She talks about this concept of trying to dig through the archives to bring people alive. And she calls it, it's so American, I have to say it in American, critical fabulation. Critical fabulation. So critical fabulation isn't making stuff up. It's trying to build a story around
some fragments
of information. And what you do then is you look at people who had similar lives or came from a similar demographic at that similar time and their journeys, and you piece it together, the likely journey that this person would have made. And what you're trying to do then is sort of breathe life into the sort of dust of the records and try to form a picture of a real person, like you would for, you know, looking at your great grandmother. You know, you don't know much about her. You might know a name if you're lucky. Some of us don't know even the names of our great grandmothers. And then you might then find who she married and how did they meet? Because he's from Colchester and she's from Glasgow. And then you ask yourself, well, in 1919, what were women doing of that age? Well, they were coming down south because that's where all the work was. And suddenly you're building a picture, you know, of somebody you didn't know and you can feel your connection to them. And that's what I suppose that I'm doing here. But anyway, to answer your first question, the Somerset case was extraordinarily important. Sancho certainly would have been aware of it, especially he would have been aware of the massive party that took place afterwards in Westminster, where 200 and more black people, they say, were having a party. I would imagine that that was probably maybe not even an exaggeration. Maybe they'd actually underplayed that because there were thousands of black people in London, and they certainly all would have known about the Somerset trial. It's been going on for months.
You've briefly touched on education before. I just wanted to talk about education potential briefly. There was a line in that John Montagu said early in the book, which was, "Words frame ideas, Sancho, as borders frame nations." I thought that was really interesting. And it's kind of the perception that education offers a way out. It offers aspiration. It offers ambition. I think for Sancho, that was the case. Of course, he said he also got very lucky. But what do you think the book says about education in the modern day?
I am of the school of thought that, look, you can educate yourself to the point at which your knowledge surpasses knowledge of a small library. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get a great job or that you're going to have a great life or any of those things. So I would say education for its own sake is what I am more interested in. I think words framing ideas has come from my own practice as a performer. I remember us, Ben Park, who's my longtime collaborator musically. He's my composer, and he performs with me on stage in this new play, Sancho and Me, for One Night Only. And what we did with a choreographer and a director was try to work up a version of Macbeth, and a lot of movement, abstract movement, we were doing with it, breaking up the words and the text, etc. And what we learned, or certainly I think one of the big lessons from that, was that you could have a lot of sort of abstract, intelligent movement and visuals and even great music. But in the end, if you don't speak word, there are no boundaries to what you're doing. It's hard to even understand fully. You can get intuitively lots of things from abstract dance. Of course you can, abstract movement. But if you actually want to hear the bare bones of what you're thinking, feeling, what the idea might be, you need verbal communication. And so that's what John is attempting to do. The other thing John is also attempting to do is the thing that I think education does give you, Thomas, which is articulation. If you ask me why 2-year-olds go ballistic and jump up and down and smash their faces on the floor and slap it, I think it's because they've got the intelligence of a 5-year-old, but the inarticulacy of a baby, and it drives them to rage because they want to express something that's quite complex and they don't have the language for it. And I know that from experience, but I also saw it working when the 2-year-old knew that they were being understood, or at least people around them were attempting to understand everything that they were doing, and actually it alleviated that rage. If you're a young person and you've got, or actually an older person, then you've got tons of ideas in your head, but there's no outlet for them. In fact, you're not even in a world where people want to hear these ideas. That can lead to all sorts of frustrations and dysfunctions. And
You just
that's
want
what,
someone to listen to you.
yeah, exactly. Want to listen and understand, he says, interrupting Thomas. But that's the thing, that education is not just about, oh, you're going to try and get a nice job. It's like that's the whole obsession with the STEM thing in this country, that you're going to have science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Well, where's your poets? Oh, we don't really need poets. Where are your dancers? Oh, we don't need dancers. We don't need all those people. They're not doing anything practical. Well, how do you know how to build a house if you don't know how human beings live? How do you know how to create an engineering product that people want and work well? You have to understand people. Who understands people better than people who've spent time contemplating people and writing about them and considering them? Poets and writers and dramatists and artists. So you're a poorer nation without these. So words frame ideas as borders frame nations is not a restriction. It is to open up the idea that you may be able to articulate an idea that otherwise would remain really nebulous and actually might enrage you. And the last thing to say is about no wickedness. No wickedness is a real, I mean, you've got to see the bad to know what your choices are going to be. I mean, if I have a world where we've all metabolized the fact that it's all fine to, if you see something on the street, just grab it, even if it belongs to somebody else. I might live in a world like that where that's acceptable. That need contrast to see, oh, there's another way. And likewise, if you live in a world where the rules are don't steal other people's stuff, and you see the consequences of somebody stealing somebody else's stuff, you see the damage it does to the person who steals it, and the damage, of course, it does to the person who's stolen from, then that might make you morally look at that and question theft. So I think you need to see the bad in order to understand it, to hide it from people, actually, to hide it from our children, for example, as some people want to do, hide the truth or hide historical truths that are painful, do no good at all, because you need to see everything. You need to make your own judgments. Of course, you've got to couch it in the right terms if you're going to explain to children harsh truths. But if they don't know them, they could well be.
Just on that, Parson, I really wanted to talk about how important it was to shine a light on the reality of the circumstances of the time in the book. We'll see specifically the letters between Anne and Sancho, which it talks about really just the real graphic horrors of her time in the Caribbean. And I think I really wanted to know how important it was to shine a light on the reality of those circumstances.
That's another good question. Sancho's life can appear to be one of privilege, and it was important to me to paint the picture of the United Kingdom as being a nation that could call itself innocent in the slave trade, really, largely, pretty much. And still today, as I say, people don't understand Britain's part in slavery, and we were the chief slaving nation, and I'm including Holland, Portugal, Spain, and France, if you look at the numbers. But actually, Sancho can't witness what he doesn't see or is not present for. So rather than it always being sort of reported to him or hearing by rumour, I wanted someone very intimate to him, his darling wife, Anne, who he just adores. You can see that all the way through his letters, completely adores her, my best half, my best self. He's besotted by her. He sends her...
My hen.
I love that the most. But I sent her to Antigua to look after, even though she's a free black woman, probably born in Whitechapel, actually. I sent her there because I want there to be a witness to the contrast with how black people are treated in London, which is not always wonderful, but certainly there is a degree of freedom and, you know, leeway. And there are black people who are with white people, and, you know, there are mixed heritage children, and we see all of this happening in London. But in the Caribbean, that's where the industrial African trafficked people, industrial levels, industrial numbers are being poured across, and death and destruction and rapes and abuse is happening on a genocidal level. And I wanted Anne, who was a sort of witness, to be in the midst of that, but not to be caught up in it, not to be just the victim of it, but to be able to witness it and articulate it for Sancho, who knows very little about it. And in that case, you get the contrast with what Britain was doing abroad and its sort of propaganda at home.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I actually didn't know that she wasn't in the Caribbean at the time. So that's very interesting that you were, you gave that perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is the license that you have when you do historical fiction. But what is not fictionalized is what happens on that estate. In fact, there is a Codrington estate. I rather randomly chose it, and I didn't want to actually paint a picture of the actual estate, because then I'd be falling into the trap of having to be restricted by some of the, you know, elements that didn't lend itself to our story or would have distracted us from our story. So there's a bit of license there, but there is a Codrington plantation. So everything you hear and everything you see witnessed is a reality, even though Anne's displacement, as far as I know, it may well be, there'll be documents that arrive that say, yes, she did visit Antigua and Barbados. As far as I know, I fabulated.
Mm-hmm. What was it like in your journey writing this book? The peaks, the valleys, how it got from, you know, your initial inception years ago to where it was now?
I started writing very tentatively. As I said, I had a bad time through education, so I didn't presume that I could just write this. I tried to give it away at least once, but it didn't come back the way I wanted it. So I wrote the monodrama as I wanted it. And that gave me a bit of confidence. And then I've always wanted to write a screenplay, so I eventually did that. And then I, even though that's not been made. And then I always wanted to deepen my knowledge of Sancho and deepen the work. And so the novel idea came. And then lockdown happened, the first one in 2020. My day job as an actor on a BBC show called Vigil ended for a hiatus. And I knew I only had a few months, but I was on my own. So I decided to dig into it then. So I sat in a shed really through all of that first lockdown summer, not really knowing what time of day it was, because I would just keep writing until, oh, the sun's up, I better go to bed. And the first huge chunk of the draft came out then. And then I spent probably, I'd say, another 10 months or so continuing to work on it, and expanding it and boiling it down and editing and re-editing, which is what writing is, just constant re-editing. And it was tricky because there's a lot happens in a life of 51 years, in Sancho's 51 years. It seems short to me now as a man in his very late 50s. I can't understand how he could have packed so much in, but he did. So I needed to do that in order. I had to have a big board up at some point to write down everything. It looks like the board of a, you know, a detective trying to figure out this, who killed Roger Rabbit. But there was such a major monolith of a life in my head that I needed to break it down that way and get it out of my own head. And that was really important for me to structure it around his life story. It was important for me to try to keep to his life and not put too much of my opinion in it. And it was also important to structure it in a way that meant I could flow. I could write in a flow, because I'd originally had a journalist who had found his diaries. So there were like three different voices, I suppose, the author, me, this journalist guy, and Sancho, and it felt too complex. So I simplified it so that it was just his diaries. So that was a big shift. And the voice is the voice I've sort of used in the play that I hear in his writing, a modified 18th century voice, because it's very dense if you try to do 18th century grammar absolutely accurately. And then, yeah, transfer that to the inner voice. And so that's what
Absolutely.
We do. Yeah.
And speaking of voice, now that you've established your own voice as a writer, and from what Madeline's told me, a hugely successful debut with this book, I wanted to ask quickly, what are your plans for the future as a novelist?
To avoid the question, what's your second novel?
Yeah, it's a very cliched question, isn't it?
It is. And yeah. By the way, you know, I mean, apart from acting, I've directed once properly and loved it. I may not ever do it again. I have written a monodrama once, loved it, may not do that again. And I've written this novel, my only novel. Love this, and I may not do this again. I've written a non-fiction book about Julius Caesar, exploring Shakespeare's African play, as I call it, and I may not ever do that again either. So I don't know. It depends what comes next. The next thing I know I'm working on is a book that is a mixture of art, history, and critical fabulation, where I'm taking these young children you often find in these 18th, 19th, even earliest portraits, where the white master is being gazed at by a black child who's designated a Negro child and black servant, but no name. So I'm doing a book about that, a couple of books that might come out in a few years if I find the time.
Thank you. And I find that really fascinating that you say that, because Sancho tried acting once and he never went back to it.
Well, that's according to his biographer. Who knows? I mean, I can't imagine that he wouldn't have persevered that a few more times. But anyway, there's a merit in really digging into something uniquely and doing it well, and not doing it as a sort of jobbing, you know, actor or jobbing. I mean, jobbing actors are brilliant actors. They're the ones who have to work all the time and have characters that, unlike Daniel Day-Lewis, they don't have 3 years to get to. But I don't want to be a sort of plodding writer who's just going to churn things out. It needs to be a labor of love.
Absolutely. And Patson, you might notice Madeline in the chat shouting at us because I meant to talk about the human experience.
Experience?
We've only got a limited time left.
The what experience?
Yeah. So the human experience. The human experience. So you can see Madeline in the chat. I think what she's written there.
I haven't seen, I can't see anything. There's nothing in my chat.
Oh, you can't.
Or
Oh,
maybe she
brilliant.
just said that to you
Okay.
privately. Ask him
Oh,
about
she
the
said
human
that to me. Right.
experience. Thomas, ask him about the human.
Yeah.
What is that question? I'll answer it quickly in 2 minutes.
Oh, it's a very long question, but I'll try and keep it brief. So, in brief, how much of this book is related to the human experience? Because we see so much of human life through Sancho's accounts, and his experience is one that I think we can all relate to, the ups and the downs. The allies and the friends and the adversaries we meet along the way.
Thomas, you've answered your own question
Yeah,
brilliantly.
I think I have, yeah.
Brilliantly. It's a, well done. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Thank you for this. It's great fun.
And that, could I just ask one last question? And do you have any tips for our writers? As you know, it's a mixture of emerging writers, many like Thomas, who are just starting out on their journey. Just as a kind of final line for us, that would be something lovely.
Yeah, I mean, I would, the only thing I say, somebody asked me this yesterday at Birmingham University when we were performing Sancho and Me for One Night Only. Have you got any writing tips? And of course, I was rushing. And I said, the only thing I would say is, and I've believed this for years, that this mantra, write what you know, needs to be examined. I didn't know anything about 18th century England when I started, not a damn thing. I didn't know anything about Black England before 1999 when I first started looking at this history. And I picked up a book called Black England by Gretchen Gerdtziner. And that began my journey. And now I know loads of stuff. So now I can write what I know, but you can get to know a whole bunch of stuff. But just make sure you know it. I would say, don't let that be a cl that cliche restrict what you can know. Men can write for women. Women can write for men. Straight people can write for gay people, and gay people can write for straight people. We can all understand each other ethnically because we're all human beings, first of all. But we absolutely have to do our research deeply, and then we can write what we know.
Thank you to Paterson Joseph for being the subject of our December interview. We'll share links so you can find out more about his work and buy a copy of his novel in the show notes for this podcast. As this is our final podcast of 2023, we'd like to wish all our listeners a happy new year. We'll see you next week for our first podcast of 2024. We're always delighted to read your contributions, so if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write On Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for Pen to Print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.